Today is April the 11th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is on a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. Yesterday was a big day in terms of computer news. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was before the Senate, and there were many questions asked over that five-hour period. We will be covering what our concerns are with Facebook in this evening's program. And to me, one of the most important exchanges was between Dick Durbin and Mark Zuckerberg. Senator Dick Durbin, who is a Democrat from Illinois, asked Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg some personal questions, like which hotel he was staying in during Zuckerberg's hearing on Tuesday. Zuckerberg was, well, he was hesitant to answer, and Durbin used that to make a broader point about data privacy. Mark Zuckerberg had come to this hearing prepared, but Durbin, who has a consumer-friendly approach to getting to one of the heart of the controversies around Facebook and privacy, seemed to have thrown Mark Zuckerberg off a bit, and the following is exchange kind of summarize the whole issue of what our concerns are. And this is the following exchange that took place.
Mr. Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about. Your right to privacy, the limits of your right to privacy, and how much you give away in modern America in the name of, quote, connecting people around the world. A question, basically, of what information Facebook's collecting, who they're sending it to, and whether they ever ask me in advance my permission to do that. Is that a fair thing for a user of Facebook to expect?
Yes, Senator. I think everyone should have control over how their information is used. And as we've talked about in some of the other questions, I think that that is laid out in some of the documents. But more importantly, you want to give people control in the product itself. So the most important way that this happens across our services is that every day people come to our services to choose to share photos or send messages. And every single time they choose to share something, they have a control right there about who they want to share it with. But that level of control is extremely important.
They certainly know within the Facebook pages who their friends are, but they may not know, as has happened, and you've conceded this point in the past, that sometimes that information is going way beyond their friends, and sometimes people have made money off of sharing that information.
Hey, Joe, you just heard the audio exchange between Dick Durbin and Mark Zuckerberg, and I don't know if you saw the video of the exchange. The look on Mark Zuckerberg's face was a memorable moment. What say you, Joe?
Yes, it was. He looked like a deer caught in the headlights of an SUV. But, you know, I got something else out of that besides what Durbin wanted me to get out of it. I realized, after 5 hours of watching it and hearing Durbin and a few other people asking, not a few other people, a couple of dozen other people asking questions, I suddenly realized that very, 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 very few of our elected officials know what the hell they're talking about. People were asking questions, not Durbin. He knew what he was asking. He had done his homework. People were asking questions that I would expect a newbie at school to be asking. They didn't know what they were talking about. They didn't know what the problems were. And here they are going to legislate things like that they know nothing about and that we're going to have to live with. I came away with something completely different from what they intended or what the CNET intended or MSNBC's commentators intended. It was very different. Now, I'd like to say one other thing. Durbin left out one question to Zuckerberg that I wish he had asked. He said, would you feel comfortable telling everybody what hotel you stayed in last night and who you messaged? But I found out a while back that it's not just who you messaged, but what the message contained. They read my private mail. They tapped my telephone.
Now, wait a minute, Joe. I have to interrupt to tell you that that's not illegal because when you signed on to Facebook, you said, yes, you can do it.
I know you knew you were going to say that to me, Hank. Now, I opened my account on Facebook years ago. I didn't really remember. I said to you when you asked me the other day, I said, well, I'm sure I did because you had to go through a series of things and click them. Well, I went back early this morning and I opened up a new account at Facebook. Guess what? I didn't have to read anything. All I had to do was attest to the fact that I had read their terms of service and their privacy agreement. They didn't present it to me there. They had a link to it if I wanted to go. Other places, I had to scroll through it, even if I didn't read it, before I got to the click or the check mark. Here, no. They didn't even make me do a check mark or a click.
Joe, let me just interrupt to say that they did not do anything illegal.
I didn't say they did anything illegal. I said people who object to it are stupid.
Well, by the way,
hold on, Hank.
Okay.
Let me stay with that point. Why do I say they're stupid? Because while Facebook didn't do anything illegal, they never said that they were going to do anything illegal. All they said was, we're going to give you a blackboard and write on it whatever you want.
But you also agreed that whatever information you give them, they had the right to do anything they want with it because you said you can do it.
That is the problem, yes. I didn't say they could do it. I didn't say they couldn't do it.
Well, let me say that one thing that came...
Just remember, I didn't swear to anything, but I did attest to the fact that I read their terms of service. Now... And I'll be generous. I didn't really count the pages. I'm estimating there were 27 pages of terms of service, and there were 5 or 6 pages covering their privacy rules.
Now, Joe, it was all in English. Now, you can read English.
Okay.
And they used simple words that you understood.
If they used more than one syllable in a word, I was stuck. Right there, I don't speak this language too good.
Well, one of the things that bothers me, Joe, one of the things that bothers me is that they have stopped. They stopped this effort, okay? From what I understand, but they were talking to Stanford Medical School about setting up a data sharing agreement with them, and I'm saying, wait a minute, that's medical data. What do you want to share my information with someone else?
Well, they don't want to share your information with someone else. What they wanted to do was to see whether by doing some data mining on the gross data that they had of them, what do they have, 1.2 billion members or something like that?
Something like that.
And they have a hell of a lot of patients out at Stanford. And they wanted to see whether they could come up with some general rules that would save people's lives. Now, that's a wonderful, wonderful goal, isn't it? Saving people's lives? How could you object to that?
Well, wait a minute. I can object to it because I know that not Facebook, but, you know, as you know, I had a major operation, and I was surprised that I was getting phone calls from different medical organizations asking me to... you know, buy this and buy that. Now, how else could they have gotten the information but other than from either the doctor or the hospital?
Well, there is a law called HIPAA, H-I-P-P-A, which is health insurance,
protection or something.
Yeah. And that wasn't around years ago when I was in the hospital. That came about 1996, I think, or 98, something like that. What they were negotiating with Stanford was to provide all of this information so they would have a big data file to search through, but without your name. So I said immediately, I said, oh, well my data is being anonymized. That's fine. It wasn't. It was being hashed into a different form, but as soon as they decided they wanted to find out whose data it was, they could reverse the hash on it. So I was being, what's the word I'm looking for, Hank? It was not being anonymous, but it was, my name was being hidden from the casual passerby.
You thought it was hidden. You thought it was hidden, but it wasn't. We spoke about this morning. I said you thought that, you know, how would they get the information? Very simple. If you're at home, you have an IP address. It's very easy to trace that IP address. And if you have it anonymized, guess what? If you didn't change your DNS address, they know who the ISP is. So, you know, there are many different ways that they can get to you.
It's not the DNS so much. But, all right, back way in ancient history, meaning earlier this year, the FCC decided, or was it the FTC?
FTC, no, the FTC.
What's his name, decided not to, or to allow ISPs to use the data they came up with. And we talked about it on the air, whether or not we should all go over to a VPN or an onion router or some other way of protecting ourselves. Well, we talked about it, and I actually started testing it with a freebie because I was too cheap to go out and buy good service just to do some tests. And I found that it slowed down my system, and it did give me what I thought was protection until Michael Horowitz was good enough to inform me that I was kidding myself. And once again, we came into an area that's much more generalized, but it's just that much more disturbing. Is anything that you get free, free?
Well,
There used to be a saying back when you were a child called, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
And that theory came about because you got the free egg and you got the free pickle and you got the free pickled beet, but they expected you to buy a pint of beer in order to do that. So you got the free lunch, but you paid for a pint of beer. Now there's no such thing as a free lunch, because if you don't pay for the product online, then you're the product.
Now, wait a minute. Zuckerberg yesterday said, they do not sell the data.
They rent it.
No, they said they do not sell the data for any money at all.
They don't. They rent it.
Well,
that's
actually,
a big difference between renting data and selling data.
No, actually, data. What they do is they do it in a different way, Joe. We looked it up, and what it is that they, as you know, when you have information, it's called clicks, all right? And what they do is they the advertisers.
It's called a click when somebody accesses a specific spot on that a specific
right.
piece of data.
They happen to know
page.
Your interest, where you've been, what you want to buy, and you were surprised to learn that some of these clicks, the advertisers will pay for those clicks. In other words, they're not really buying the data, but in a way, they're getting the information based on paying an advertising rate. Okay. In other words, if I'm XYZ Corporation, I want to advertise. Oh, by the way, since I'm advertising, I would like to have you give me some information that meets my criteria. And I was surprised that some of these clicks are $5 a click. That's a lot of money.
It is and it isn't. Back when I was in the mail order business, Hank, I used to feel that if I could get 2% responses to my advertising, that was a successful campaign. And I would mail out 1 million to 2 million pieces, and I was paying anything around $10, $11, $12, $15 a thousand for those names. Now, if you do the arithmetic, it's not too much different. If I'm paying $5 a name for my mailing list, but I'm told that that's specifically the people who are going to buy my type of product, then it's not a question of my getting 2%. I'll probably get 20 or 30 or 40%.
Well, without identifying the organization, they were bragging that they were getting a 78% hit.
Which, you know, if Doubleday and Company ever got that with the book clubs that they ran,
they would still be in business.
They wouldn't be in business anymore. They all would have retired as multimillionaires.
Yeah.
The thing is that Zuckerberg and his friends were doing is they were breaking down their list to people with specific demographics, specific buying habits, specific interests. How do they know the interests? I'll tell you how they know the interests, Hank. Day before yesterday, I went on to Amazon to buy some LED dimmable light bulbs for a light fixture I have here at home. I had a big problem because I wanted simply to replace bulb for bulb exactly. I needed 3-watt dimmable, so many lumens and so on, cool white, a 4000K. And I had a lot of specs. And going through the entire internet, I could not find anybody who would sell me that particular bulb. But they had others that were very close, and I went on to Amazon and bought the others that were very close. And I was told they'd be delivered today. Incidentally, they were. They arrived today. Yesterday, Joanna opened up her Facebook, and by God, there was a company advertising dimmable LED light bulbs. Coincidence? What do you think, Hank?
I guess you never read the book 1984, then.
I not only read it, it's my Bible.
Yeah. Hey, Joe. Dick Durbin talking about sharing of data, and Sheryl Sandberg had said that while Facebook is giving users the option to opt out of sharing some data, an option to not share any data would be a paid product. And you said to me, what option?
I did.
Because
they
she said
no
you can opt out, but you're saying, where is it? And by the way, if you opt out, you got to pay for it.
Everything has to have a business model of some sort. Now, Facebook can really be free and nobody pay anything and all the data on it can be private. But somebody is going to have to, maybe Kupferberg would do it himself. He's a billionaire. Somebody has to pay for it. Right now, Hank, you had the actual figures. I only had estimates. What's mm-hmm. the gross revenue right now?
Well, the numbers I have is somewhat dated, but it's very accurate from the year 2008 to 2013. And I was, I said, what a company. In 2008, their revenue from advertising was $272 million with an M. 5 years later, that $272 million in 2013 became $7.8 billion with a B. What
now,
a jump.
We're not talking about pretzels here. We're talking about, what was it, the senator from Illinois many, many years ago said, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Everett Dirksen.
Now, Mr. Dirksen was a prophet, no question about it.
Well, Joe, let me ask you this question. One of the things that came out was that you can send email messages in Facebook, and what got me was that Zuckerberg and some of his key people have the option of eliminating the message as if it never happened. But it's right now, of course, they didn't say they were beta testing it. They say, well, they'll make it available to the general Facebook subscribers at some point in time.
Now, you said Zuckerberg and his key people, but we don't know how many key people. Is it, you know, 2 or 3 key people or 2 or 300 key people?
Actually, I have more information on that. It was reported, I forgot which outlet, that virtually all the employees were doing it.
Exactly. Now, when you say virtually all the employees...
Well, because there's nothing absolute like all, okay?
I don't know how many employees they have, and I don't know why Zuckerberg would arrange to go into my inbox and erase a message he sent me 2.5 to 3 years ago.
But you have to understand that you agree to whatever he does, he can do.
No, I never agreed to that, I don't think. I didn't read carefully all 27 pages, but pretty much. The point being, they were doing something that other places are doing openly and publicly, and he was doing it secretly. What do I mean? There are some social media sites out there where you post a picture or a message for a period of time, and then it disappears. That's similar in concept, except he picks the amount of time. Hey, you know, that would be very handy. I could go out and libel somebody or threaten somebody. And when the FBI came after me, I'd say, well, where's the evidence? And they say, well, you sent so-and-so an email. I said, really? Show it to me. It's gone. It's gone. Fell out of his mailbox.
Well, Joe, this raises the question, should they be regulated? And if yes, how would you regulate them?
The answer is twofold. Yes, they should be regulated. And I don't have the vaguest idea how you would go about doing that.
Well, I heard the answer from Zuckerberg. I also heard the answer from Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple. And the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, said it should be well-regulated, meaning you regulate Facebook, but don't regulate us. And what Zuckerberg says, oh, I believe in regulations, but you have to apply to everyone.
Here's the thing. I get very, very, very nervous when somebody wants to regulate somebody else. Right now I have 100% control over Zuckerberg and what he does. You know what that control is? I can get out of Facebook whenever I want. Now, supposedly I have deleted everything that Facebook currently had on file on me, supposedly. But how do I know what I deleted? I know what I told the computer to delete. But for all I know, that's going out. The command is going out into a Bitbucket, and they simply put a flag on my files saying, "Don't show these to anybody, including him." It's dangerous. Now that I know what Facebook is, the instructions that I've said here on the air so many hundreds of times over the last 30 odd years becomes even more permanent. Do not post anything. Any place online that you would not be comfortable with your mother or your grandmother or your great-grandmother standing up in church or temple on holy days and announcing proudly to the audience. If you don't feel comfortable with that, then don't talk about it. If you don't feel comfortable with that, don't take a photo of it.
I just want to remind everyone that our mantra has always been backup, backup, backup.
And I am sure that Facebook does that religiously. When they say delete, they're talking about the information not being online, but they do religious backups, and that means that the data is retained for whatever that retention period is for a very long period of time, sitting in some warehouse or in some iron mountain that they can easily retrieve.
And you say that it's for some period of time. Give me an idea. What period of time would you guess?
Okay. How about
my guess? My guess is forever.
It can be forever. When people ask me how long should they keep a backup, it varies anywhere from 3 years to 7 years, and the safe thing I always say is 7 years.
Well, you could be wrong, Hank. If you do your taxes, for example, online, how long would you keep the records of this year's taxes online?
For me, I would delete it, except that Google will, whoever is providing the online service, TurboTax, they have it for whatever their company policy is, and I have no control over that.
Well, how long are you required by law to keep that data available?
I use the 7 years, some people say 3 years, but I go 7 years.
And if I told you, under certain circumstances, you have to keep it forever, what would you say? And I'm talking about the law.
The law?
If there's any fraud, conscious fraud, in your tax return, as much as $1 worth, you by law have to keep it forever.
You know, the funny thing about the law, Joe, is that the way the law is being interpreted is you're guilty until you're proven innocent.
That's not true.
That's not true. Hey, Joe, I want to ask you a quick question because I know a lot of people are asking me that because they miss you. You haven't been on the air on a consistent basis.
Wait a minute. You left me hanging there.
Yeah, I know. But wait. I want you to answer this, okay? You're in fine voice today. What did you do?
Have you ever heard of a thing called TCM?
Traditional Chinese medicine.
Have you ever heard of a thing? I'm going to mispronounce it.
don't even pronounce it.
it looks like a tangerine that's been sitting in the basement for a couple of years. Have you ever seen a 1,000-year-old egg? Yeah. It looks a little bit like that.
Well, let me tell you, listening audience, that I had Joe, after, 4 or 5 months of seeing many doctors, I said, try TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, and I brought some in for him. And he said, this stinks. It is like I got to hold my nose. So I asked Joe, if you have to hold your nose, why do you take it?
Well, like anything else.
It works.
Why would I use Facebook? Because it works.
Hey, now, Joe.
Your wife gave me a good clue.
Yeah.
She said, if you really can't stand the taste, some people don't mind it, but if you really can't stand it, try putting in a tablespoon of honey into every cup.
And it works.
And that's exactly what I've been. Actually, the honey helps soothe my throat, while what's the Chinese name of it, Hank?
It's Lo Hon Kuo.
Now,
I dare you to even pronounce it. Okay. Hey, Joe, let me...
L-O-U-H-A-N-G-U-O. And do not go into your CVS pharmacy.
You won't find it.
And ask. They won't even know what you're talking about. But if you have a really bad inflamed throat where you can't talk and you can't swallow, give Hank a call.
Joe, tell you what, I'd like to end this segment discussion on Facebook. Can you tell me what you would tell someone who says, should I get off of Facebook?
I'm not going to tell you, should you get off of Facebook. I'm going to say this. If you put onto Facebook anything that can really identify you, I would be hesitant to go on Facebook. Not that there's anything in your profile, but remember that profile is going to be added to your tax return, to your medical record, to your school points, and you're going to be part of a giant big data collection. And when they go to farm every little bit of extra information. Maybe one day you said you graduated from high school, and then on Facebook you never put down any friends from college or high school. If you don't care about all of that, and you don't care what in the future they can mine out of that data that you're not even thinking about.
Joe, tell you what.
On Facebook.
Let me tell you what my response is, okay? Harvard just conducted a survey of millennials between the age of 18 to 29, and they found that only 4% of millennials trust Facebook. And my response to the whole thing is, learn what the facts are. If you know what the facts are and you want to be on Facebook, you know what? Go ahead. But since you know what the risk is. But from my own personal point of view, I don't trust it.
Okay. But let me ask you a question. What's wrong with those 4%?
Listen, I'm going to wrap up this thing on Facebook. Take care, Joe.
Take care, Hank.
For tonight, our feature segments are From the Tech Corner. I'll be talking about computer tech support fraud, and Marty Winston will be covering home automation on ways to avoid failure modes in the Raspberry Pi. Based on new reporting, the Internet Crime Complaint Center, otherwise known as IC3, is providing updated guidance regarding technical support fraud. Technical support fraud involves a criminal claiming to provide customer security or technical support in an effort to defraud unwitting individuals. This type of fraud continues to be a problematic and, well, a widespread scam. Last year, in 2017, the IC3 received approximately 11,000 complaints related to tech support fraud. The claim losses amounted to nearly $15 million, which represented an 80% increase from 2016. And most of this is probably just the tip of the iceberg, as a lot of it is unreported. While majority of the tech support fraud involves victims in the United States, IC3 has received complaints from victims in 85 different countries. Criminals may pose as a security, customer, or technical support rep, offering to resolve such issues as a compromised email or bank account, a virus on your computer, or to assist with a software license renewal. Some recent complaints involve criminals posing as technical support reps for GPS, printer, or cable companies, or provide for virtual currency exchanges. As this type of fraud has become a more commonplace, criminals have started to pose as government agents, even offering to recover supposed losses related to tech support fraud schemes or to request financial assistance with apprehending criminals. How the fraud occurs. Initial contact with the victim typically occurs through the following methods. Telephone. A victim receives an unsolicited telephone call from an individual claiming the victim's device or computer is infected with a virus or is sending error messages to the caller. Callers are generally reported to have strong foreign accents. Individuals in need of tech support may use online search engines to find technical support companies. Companies pay to have their fraudulent tech support company links show higher in search results, hoping victims would choose one of the top links in search results. Pop-up message. The victim receives an on-screen pop-up message claiming a virus has been found on their computer. In order to receive assistance, the message requests the victim call a phone number associated with a fraudulent tech support company. Lock screen on a device. The victim's device displays a frozen lock screen with a phone number and instructions to contact a fraudulent tech support company. Some victims have reported being redirected to alternate websites before the lock screen occurs. By the way, if you get a lock screen, just turn off the machine, bring it up again. That's how you bypass it. Pop-up and lock screens, often accompanied by a recorded verbal message to contact a phone number for assistance. Frequently programmed into links for advertising or popular topics on social media. Web addresses of popular websites such as social media or financial websites can be typo-squatted to result in a pop-up or locked screen if the victim incorrectly types the intended website address. Phishing is another form of email warning. The victim receives a phishing email warning of a possible intrusion into their computer or email warning of a fraudulent account charged to their bank account or credit card. The email provides a phone number for the recipient to contact the fraudulent tech support. If you get that, and if the number is not recognizable or you're familiar with, ignore it. Don't worry about being sued because you didn't respond to it. Once the fraudulent tech support company makes the verbal contact with the victim, the criminal tries to convince the victim to provide remote access to the victim's device. If the device is a tablet or smartphone, the criminal often instructs the victim to connect the device to a computer. Once remotely connected, the criminal claims to find expired licenses, viruses, malware, or scareware. The criminal will inform the victim the issue can be removed for a fee. Criminals usually request payment through personal or electronic check or an electronic check with a bank or wire transfer or debit credit card or prepaid card or virtual currency. Another widespread issue is the fake refund. In this scheme, the criminal contacts the victim offering a refund for tech support services previously rendered. The criminal requests access to the victim's device and instructs the victim to log into their online bank account to process a refund. As a result, the criminal gains control of the victim's device and bank account. With this access, the criminal makes it appear as if too much money was refunded to the victim's account and requests the victim return the difference back to the criminal's company via a wire transfer or prepaid cards. In reality, there was no refund at all. Instead, the criminal transferred funds among the victim's own accounts, checking savings, retirement, etc., to make it appear as though funds were deposited. The victims returns their own money to the criminals. The refund and return process can occur multiple times, resulting in the victims potentially losing thousands of dollars. Variations and trends. Well, there are many of them. Tech support fraud was originally an attempt by criminals to gain access to devices to extort payment for fraudulent services. However, criminals are creating new techniques and versions of the scheme. Criminals pose as government agents or officials or law enforcement. The criminal offers assistance in recovering losses from a previous tech support fraud incident. The criminal either requests funds from the victim to assist with investigation or to cover fees associated with returning the lost funds. Criminals pose as collection services, claiming the victim did not pay for prior tech support services. The victim is often threatened with legal action if the victim does not pay a settlement fee. Then there's virtual currency. Virtual currency is increasingly targeted by tech support criminals, with individual victim losses often in the thousands of dollars. Criminals pose as virtual currency support. Victims contact fraudulent virtual currency support numbers, usually located via open source searches. The fraudulent support asks for access to the victim's virtual currency wallet and transfers the victim's virtual currency to another wallet for temporary holding during maintenance. The virtual currency is never returned to the victim, and the criminal ceases all communications. Criminals who have access to a victim's electronic device use the victim's personal information and credit card to purchase and transfer virtual currency to an account controlled by the criminal. Increasing use of victim's personal information and accounts to conduct additional fraud. Criminals use the victim's personal information to request fraud bank transfers or open new accounts to accept and process unauthorized payments. Criminals send phishing emails to the victim's personal contacts from the victim's computer. Criminals download personal files containing criminals send phishing emails to the victim's personal contacts from the victim's computer. Criminals download personal files containing financial accounts, passwords and personal data, health records and social security numbers and tax information. Additionally, IC3 complaint also reports of criminal who took control of victim's devices and accounts and did not release control unless a ransom was paid.
Viruses, keylogging software, and malware were installed on victims' devices. Criminals have become more belligerent, hostile, and abusive if challenged by victims. Suggestions for protection. Remember that legitimate customer, security, or tech support companies will not initiate unsolicited contact with individuals. Install ad-blocking software that eliminates or reduces pop-ups and malware. Be cautious of customer support numbers obtained via open-source searching. Phone numbers listed in a sponsored results section are likely boosted as a result of search engine advertising. Recognize fraudulent attempts and cease all communications with the criminal. Resist the pressure to act quickly. Criminals will urge the victim to act fast to protect their device. The criminals create a sense of urgency to produce fear and lure the victim into immediate action. Do not give unknown, unverified persons remote access to devices or accounts. Ensure all computer antivirus, security, and malware protection programs are up to date. Some victims report their antivirus software provided warnings prior to attempt. Well, if you're a victim, individuals who receive a pop-up or lock screen should shut down the device immediately. Ignore any pop-ups instructing to not power off or restart the computer. Victims who reported shutting down the device and waiting a short time to restart usually find the pop-up or screen lock has disappeared. Do not, and I repeat, do not, recontact fraudulent tech scam companies. Expect additional fraudulent calls as these companies often share their customer database information. Should a criminal gain access to a device or an account, individuals should take precautions to protect their identity. Immediately contact financial institutions to place protection on accounts as well as change passwords and actively monitor accounts and personal information for suspicious activity. File a complaint. Individuals who believe they may be a victim of an online scam, regardless of the dollar amount, should file a complaint with the IC3, and that's www.ic3.gov. It's a government agency. The more often fraud and scams are reported, the better equipped the enforcement can be made to address the issues. To report tech support fraud, please be as descriptive as possible in the complaint, including the following. 1. Identifying information of the criminal and company. Include the website, phone numbers, and email addresses used by the criminal and company or any other numbers that you may have called. 2. Account names and numbers and financial institutions receiving any funds. For example, bank accounts, wire transfers, prepaid card payments, virtual currency wallets, even if the funds were not actually lost. 3. Description of interaction with the criminal. And 4. Their email, website, or link that caused a pop-up or lock screen. Complainants are also encouraged to keep all original documentation, emails, faxes, and logs of all communications. Because scams and fraudulent website appears very quickly, individuals are encouraged to report possible internet scams and fraudulent website by filing a complaint with IC3 at ic3.gov. To view previously released PSAs and scam alerts, you could visit IC3's press room at ic3.gov/media/default.aspx. Like many computers, the little Raspberry Pi that Marty uses all over his cybernetic house has failure modes. Marty not only explains them, he explains a way to avoid them by taking a few sizable steps towards Raspberry Pi immortality, and maybe a useful hint or two for your PC.
In several of our previous Cybernetic House segments, I said or suggested that there's a way to make a Raspberry Pi computer live and keep working a lot longer than most people would expect. And you know what? A lot of what I have to say about extending the life expectancy of a Raspberry Pi can also help most computers delay those fatal failures. I'll get into death preventers specific to the Raspberry Pi in a second, but here are two core considerations that translate to other systems. One is heat. Heat accelerates aging in most electronic components and many electronic connections. The other is main drive file or file table corruption, which most often happens when there are power disruptions while writing to disk. To put it simply, it's an interrupted handshake, or if you're feeling romantic, an interrupted kiss, overwriting fond memories with confusion. Isn't that cute? Okay, let's cut into the pie and start with heat. There's almost nothing you can do with a Raspberry Pi that will heat it up as much as connecting a monitor to its HDMI port. If you need that display head, you're not going to get around the heat issue, but you're also a little less likely to keep it running 24/7. One alternative is a terminal connection, where you don't use the HDMI port. Another alternative, the one we choose, is totally headless operation, meaning no user interface at all. That little HDMI heat maker never fires up. I also add heat sinks to the two biggest ICs on the board, even though everything I read tells me they're unnecessary. Here's my reasoning. The additional surface area of the heatsink fins has to help convective cooling, and even a few degrees of difference can make a difference in reducing component aging. I said convective cooling, and that means airflow. So I mount the boards vertically, using spacers to provide airflow on all six sides. The second most likely heat source is its CPU, and the third most likely is its RAM. There are several ways to reduce CPU heating. One is to program in a compiled language like C++ instead of an interpreted language like Python, both of which are available on the Raspberry Pi. One is to do less programming in a polling approach, which keeps programs running in loops to check for things happening. It's less work for the CPU to use a mechanism called interrupts, which is more or less the computer equivalent of waiting for somebody to knock on the door instead of repeatedly getting up to see if anybody's there. Still another is to divide and conquer. Bringing in one or more additional network-connected Raspberry Pi nodes so they each have less work to do. Many of the same things that keep the CPU running cooler will also mean less memory traffic, which can cut down on how hot memory gets. Also, the onboard radios that support wireless protocols like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth can turn off when those protocols aren't in use. When you do all these things, you end up with a very cool running little computer, which helps avoid that heat-induced premature component aging, leaving us with that other challenge of not letting anything corrupt its main drive. In the case of the Raspberry Pi, that's a microSD card. If you can't avoid writing to that flash memory, oversize it to spread the data across its internal landscape. For me, if I need to use 2 gig on the card, I'll get a 32 gig card and get it from a brand I trust. A lot of internal write errors happen from repeated overwrites of the same memory addresses. Going bigger helps avoid that. Know what totally avoids it? Never writing to the microSD card. That takes some figuring out. It means that you can't use it as a virtual memory swap space. So all of your operations, from the operating system to the support libraries to the programs you're running, all of that has to fit the 1 gig of physical memory that's on the board. There's no way to expand that physical memory, no way to make it any bigger. That's not all, but we'll take a minute here. The Raspberry Pi Model 3 uses any of several incarnations of Linux. In Linux, these various versions are called distributions. Linux also gives you a chance to be selective in which elements you load. For example, if we never run Python programs, we never need the Python interpreter. There are already some compatible distributions out there that are way thinned down and can significantly reduce the amount of memory the operating system occupies. The things they leave out are not things you're likely to use if you run headless without a user interface. But even with a minimal distribution, even with compiled programs, even with the swap file disabled and no virtual memory writes trying to happen, there's still something that will keep wanting to write to that SD card. It's a Linux thing. Lots and lots of log files. And if you run into trouble, those can have the information you need to fix it. So we want to let them keep writing, only not to the micro SD card. The answer is, here's a mnemonic, 234, meaning a USB 2 flash drive can plug into any of the Raspberry Pi 3's 4 USB ports. Configure the system to always write those log files to that little USB drive, and your micro SD card really can run as read-only. One tip if you do that, include one tiny file on the micro SD card and another tiny file on the USB 2 flash drive, giving each one a name that would never normally occur. And just for the heck of it, put them in a subdirectory folder that also has a name you would never normally see when computing. Linux has a scheduling utility called cron, C-R-O-N. And maybe once every 24 hours, check to see that those files are still there. If they aren't, of course, there's a really good chance that something really bad happened to that flash storage, either the micro SD card or the USB 2 drive. Let me add one more set of comments because I know Hank is going to ask. We have several sets of stored data images of each and every micro SD card in our system and can create a new replacement in a few minutes. Atop that, our nodes will each keep one prepared spare in its housing. Further, we place a large capacitor across the 5-volt DC bus that powers the Raspberry Pi to eat any glitches that might ever make it through to that bus. We create the power on that bus from regulated power supplies that are each plugged into a UPS, and there's a backup generator behind the UPS. Yes, indeed, we back up. Because bringing a crashed system back up is always the easiest and least expensive to accomplish if it never goes down in the first place. Hank?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Amazon Echo Dot Home Assistant, Thursday, April the 12th, at 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, April the 13th at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and it will be at the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The Princeton PCs User Group will be meeting Tuesday, April the 24th at 7 p.m., Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on VPN, the importance of having one, Thursday, April the 26th. The meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 1st. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will have their general meeting May 3rd, Thursday. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor at White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on May 4th, Friday. Meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or www.wbai.org streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.